The Guardian.
My favourite book is called Snakehead. It's written by Anthony Horowitz. I like it because it's action-packed and it's got loads of adventures in it.
I'm reading Doctor Who.
I recently read Memoirs of a Geisha.
How many light bulbs does it take to change the planet?
At the moment, I'm reading a book called Hive. It's really good.
For a good night story, my dad's reading Under the Mishmash Trees.
Spiderwick Chronicles, about fairies and stuff.
I'm reading Pippi Longstockings and I think it's good.
A brief glimpse there into the reading habits and literary tastes of the many young people here at the Hay Festival. I'm Claire Armistead and you're listening to the fourth Guardian Haycast, which today is all about children and young people and what they read. Joining me on the panel are Owen Colfer, creator of the wonderfully named anti-hero Artemis Fowl, the poet and playwright and broadcaster Lem Cisse, and author Francesca Simon, who is responsible for, among other things, introducing the world to the antics of horrid Henry. Welcome, all of you. Coming up later in the programme, we'll be hearing from Julia Donaldson, who wrote the Gruffalo books. There's also a sneak preview of the forthcoming film, The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, plus an interview with director Mark Herman and John Boyne, who wrote the book on which the film is based. But first, it seems to me that there's a particular magic about the books you read as a child, or as a teenager indeed. I know I can never forget a book called The Ship That Flew by a woman called Hilda Lewis. I bet none of you have ever heard of that.
No. It sounds fabulous.
It was absolutely fantastic. And I wondered whether you could tell me what your favourite books, just very quickly, were as a child. Lem?
I'm going to go for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Ah.
Roald Dahl.
Francesca?
Half Magic by Edward Eger.
Owen?
Stig of the Dump.
Stig of the Dump.
Was my
That's my second favourite. Now, my first guest is indeed Owen Colfer. And Owen, I know many young people would answer the question about their favourite book by mentioning Artemis Fowl. It was first published in 2001, which was, I think, the first year I came to Hay, and I must have seen you fairly shortly after that. And I've been lucky enough to get my hands on a copy of the next one, which is out in August. And we'll come to your new book, just come out in a minute, but tell us a bit about Artemis Fowl and why you think it was so successful.
I don't know, really, because I thought up to then I had written about mildly naughty boys and I had been criticised in the papers somewhat. So I thought, I'm just going to be buried with this because this guy he's not good at all. But then apparently boys are naughty. Who knew? So
never.
So, yeah. So when it came out then, it became, it was well received and boys liked it. And I think when I talk to kids about it, I say, what do you like about this guy? And I always expect them to say magic or jokes or, passing wind. But it seems to be that he controls grown-ups and they would love to have that control over their teachers and whatever. So this guy outsmarts if you are a grown-up, he's most annoying and infuriating, but if you're a kid, he's like a hero for that reason.
And when you launch the book, you're doing a tour, I gather. You're going to do a stage show, and it's called Fairies, Fiends and Flatulence.
Yes.
And I think flatulence is an important thing here as well.
That's a shameless ploy to get boys to come to the show. I said, we have to get the word flatulence on the poster somehow, and that will guarantee us a big audience. So I can't actually guarantee there will be any flatulence at the show.
Oh, man. So Francesca,
oh, what the hell? Yes, there will.
So, Francesca, is there flatulence in Horrid Henry?
Certainly not. No, I actually think that the books kind of give the illusion of great wickedness. But in fact, I was very interested in what Owen was saying, because it is a lot about somebody who is very controlled, i.e. all children, taking charge of things and managing to get their own way through scheming, through clever tricks, through good luck. And there is, I think, that element that children really enjoy about somebody who is transgressive in that way. I mean, it's almost like liberation, books about, being free, I think. Because I think all children feel very much under the thumb of their parents, which they are, and their life is spent being told what to do, and to have somebody who just is like, no, I won't. I mean, it is annoying for the parent, but for the child, it's absolutely fantastic. It's expressing all this stuff that's inside them, but that they're being socialized, which they have to be, not to necessarily express.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my son reads Hard Henry or watches the cartoon. He's with a notebook. Uh-huh, yeah, okay. Tomorrow I'm doing this, this, and this. So
No. That's surely not true. He's writing down all the things that he knows he must not do because he's been allowed, to express this in a safe way through literature.
That's
Therefore,
good.
He's even better the next day. Correct.
But there's also a sense that Horrid Henry is writing injustice, and this brings us to your new book, Airmen. The hero is Conant Brockhart. How do you pronounce that?
Brockhart.
Brockhart, which sounds sort of, it sounds sort of Flemish or Dutch or something.
It is, it's Flemish name because his family followed my own family from over with the Normans, so I traced back to find names that would actually exist.
Which explains also why there's quite a bit of French in the book.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. They came over with Strongbow and all these guys and Raymond Le Gros. And the Colfers were the laziest Normans because we landed in Wexford town. And I said, oh, you know what the hell, we're staying here. You guys go on, conquer. You conquer Dublin, this is fine for us. So we made one little boat trip and then settled. And the Brockharts were kind of the same.
Very beautiful area, though, too.
That's
they,
amazing.
They must have just arrived and thought, you know what?
Yeah.
Compared to those fjords.
Yeah.
But Connor is battling evil, isn't he?
He is. It's a very old-fashioned book. And the feeling I wanted to try and capture was the feeling I had as a child. And I remember very, very vividly, I was in a library. Maybe I was 12 or 13, and I found this book, which hadn't... And I checked the flap, and it hadn't been checked out since the 60s. And it was actually dusty. It was like a movie. And it was called Black Bartlemy's Treasure. And when you find a book like that, it's like discovering treasure. And that's what I wanted to do, to recreate the feeling that you got this book in your granddad's house and no one had read it for years. And it was just a goldmine of adventure. So that's what I wanted to try and capture.
Mm-hmm. Lem, you're a patron of something called the Letterbox Club, which is about sending children books to children in care.
Yeah.
Is that right?
The job is to let all children in care have a series of books posted to them in an envelope with their name on it.
From somebody who signs
from the Letterbox Club.
From the Letterbox Club.
Yeah. The other patron's Jacqueline Wilson.
Ah, the great Jacqueline Wilson.
Yes, Her Royal Highness.
A lot of children's books are predicated on the loss of a parent, aren't they, famously?
They absolutely are. As Superman. You know, so much, children in care, children in distress in some way, actually, are central, it seems to me, to a lot of children's books. Quite wonderful, but ignored things, seemingly, that kids in care are so prevalent in children's books. I don't hear that said a lot.
But in a way, they're children in care to be read by children who are not in care. And I heard a wonderful phrase a little while ago, which is the thrill of safe fear. So it's fear, but you're not actually frightened. Francesca, is that something that's relevant to your world?
Oh, I think absolutely, because I believe very strongly that that children love reading about things that do scare them, but they know it's safe. I mean, just like we all love going to the theater, or going to films, or watching, or reading books. It's to have that chance to explore other people's lives in a safe way, and to really kind of go out on the edge. And we're always looking for thrilling books. I mean, I'm really enjoying Owen's book because it reminded me actually of a book I completely love, like The Three Musketeers, and that kind of Man in the Iron Mask, and that kind of big adventure.
Lovely. We'll hear more from our panel shortly. But firstly, as the rain continues to pour down on the roof over our heads, here's Hadley Freeman, The Guardian's deputy fashion editor, with her take on the weather forecast and the all-important Hay Festival question, what on earth do you wear?
Outbreaks of torrential rain forecast across Wales and all Hereford.
Well, the weather is not going to get in the way of my fashion decision-making. The only torrential rain kind of fashion film reference I can think of would be Kate Winslet drowning on the Titanic. So I guess that would be an evening gown and slightly streaky makeup. And, okay, my blow-dry will go to hell, but, you know, wet hair is kind of sexy too.
Now, Julia Donaldson has written many books, but's probably best known for conjuring into existence a large hairy creature called the Gruffalo. She's here at Hay doing a series of workshops, and I went along to meet her and her long-suffering but not hairy husband.
And now I need to introduce you to our author, whose books are too numerous and well-loved for me to mention. A big Hay Festival, clap and cheer, please welcome Julia Donaldson.
Julia, you're in Hay to launch three new books, I gather, but you're doing so in an unusual way by doing these workshops.
I never do author talks. You can't really anywhere do author talks when half your audience are sort of 3 or 4 years old. You know, you've got to keep them entertained. So what I always do is act the stories. And in fact, I have a cast which has been steadily growing over the years. I've got my husband, my sister. It's a very family affair. So we act out Tyrannosaurus Drip. That's a story about dinosaurs. And the audience are the vegetarian dinosaurs, and the people on the stage are the horrible meat-eating dinosaurs. So it's very dramatic.
Could you all be dinosaurs?
Now, we've got another very special person here sitting right beside you, who is Malcolm, your husband, who I gather is the Gruffalo.
Yes, I act some of the characters in Julia's books, normally the bad ones and the stupid ones. I'm still waiting for a part as an intelligent hunk.
No, I think he's really moaning about nothing. I mean, I just have to get to be the narrator, which is really boring, or else the good ones. It's, I can tell you, I'd love to be a villain or a... or someone stupid, you know. I just have to be the clever good ones all the time.
Now, you're a singer before you were a writer, and you wrote and performed songs for children's television. What's your first love? Are you ever divided between you in loyalties between your writing and performing?
Well, luckily I don't have to be divided. They're equally important to me. As you know, some of my life is very quiet and introspective of doing the writing, and then I go to theatres and book festivals and I'm allowed to just show off and sing, not particularly well, but you know, do all those things that I love doing. So it's great to do both.
The Gruffalo was picked up by number 11 Downing Street, wasn't it, as a Christmas card for the last year that Gordon Brown was Chancellor. Was that a surprise to you?
Yes, it was a surprise, and I was even more delighted when he was on a Radio 4 programme to choose his five favourite books of all time, and he chose The Snail and the Whale, which is one of mine. And none of the others were children's books, I hasten to add.
And one other question is about colour. I'm really interested in the way that colour comes into your writing and then how that's picked up in the illustrations. I notice you referred to if you gave somebody one coloured hair, they can't go and choose another one.
That's interesting you should say that. I have written a book about colours, actually, called The Princess and the Wizard, which is a book about camouflage, actually, and the princess is trying to escape from the wizard and she can change her colour, so she turns herself into yellow chicken and hides in the straw and so on. So, yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, but I am fascinated by colours, I suppose.
Julia Donaldson. Apparently, she made up the word Gruffalo by simply trying to find something that would be easy to rhyme with. But now you can't imagine the book without it. Lem, you work as a poet. Tell us a bit about rhyme and your use of language.
I have fun with it. I have fun with it personally, you know, in my writing, and that translates hopefully to audience.
Are you going to give us a taste of the fun in your work?
Yes, I have a particular poem, but it's not necessarily as fun, but it does mean something to me. Suitcases and muddy parks. You say I'm a lying child. I say I'm not. You say, there you go again. You say I'm a rebellious child. I say, no, I am not. You say, there you go again. Quite frankly, Mum, never seen a rebellious child before. And when my mate said, race you through the park, you know, the muddy one, I didn't think about the mud. When you said, why are you dirty? I could hear the anger in your voice. I said, I raced my mates through the park. You said, it was deliberate. I said, I didn't. I mean, I did. But it wasn't. You said I was lying. I said, no, I'm not. You said, there you go again. Later, in the dawn of adolescence, it was time for my leave. I with my suitcase and social worker. You with your husband, we walked our sliced ways. Sometimes I'd run back to you. Like a child through a muddy park, with adult achievements tucked under my arm, then I'd explain them with a childlike twinkle in my eye, thinking any mother would be proud. But your eyes, desperately trying to be wise and unrevealing, revealed all. Still, you fell back into the heart of the same rocking chair, saying, there you go again. And I did go. And I have. I've gone.
Thank you very much. That was Lem Sisse reading Suitcases and Muddy Parks from his book Rebel Without Applause. Lem, I understand you've just had a birthday, but I probably shouldn't ask you how old you are.
Okay. No, you can. No, it's all documented. I'm 40 years old. And you know what? I'm getting the good stuff.
It only lasts about 6 months.
So there is something to look forward to.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So do you feel that you have to write differently for young people? I mean, you're not one anymore. We have to admit this.
Yeah, no, I think writing for young people is, I mean, amongst the present company, is the most difficult of all of the forms, I think. I think that they're the most critical audience. If they don't like it, they don't pick it up. Adults, if they don't like it but they hear that it's good, they'll pick it up. If they don't like it and they're reading it, they may continue, as I do when I'm reading. You know, children, no. You know, it's they vote with their feet.
That poem that you've just read,
yes,
could be appreciated by children.
It's been read on a TV programme for children. It's been read for children many times, and some may understand parts of it and miss other parts of it, and that is okay. It's okay not to understand.
Francesca, you use alliteration a lot, notably in Horrid Henry, don't you? You've got Perfect Peter, who just, you can just, don't you just feel how obnoxious he must be to Horrid Henry, having so many P's in his name?
I think English works incredibly well with alliteration. I mean, it's an old form. I did Anglo-Saxon at university, and you really hear that those kind of consonants click. It's just also huge fun, the idea that somebody could be completely summed up by one adjective. And that's all they do. So Weepy William is just always crying. He's the child that everything dreadful always happens, the one who always leaves his lunch behind and, you know, wets his pants and forgets his swimming costume and things like that. And I think kids just find it funny to have a collection of kids with all these attributes.
Mm. Owen, you're writing for a slightly older age group, yes, but I'm fascinated by the words. You have some quite difficult words in there that I need a dictionary to find out what they actually mean.
Well, I suppose I come from the background of being a primary teacher for 15 years. And when I started to write, people would say to me, mostly adults, you know, there's some very difficult words in here. And I'm saying, good!
Yes.
You know, yeah, they, yes, learn, absolutely, something and from the context. When I was 12, I was reading my parents' books, as I suspect most of us were. And I love Robert Ludlum's books because he had put Russian in and he would never explain it. So you'd have to, first of all, try and pronounce it, and then second of all, work out what it meant. And I love that, and I reckon there's a lot of kids out there like I was, and they would revel in these challenges, and they would like the long words.
And I agree completely. I mean, children spend their lives learning words. I remember reading Swallows and Amazons to my son when he was about 4, and there was a whole page of, to me, incomprehensible gobbledygook about sailing. And about halfway through, I said, I have to tell you, I have no idea what I've just read. And my son said, I don't mind, I like hearing the words. And that was a complete revelation to me as well as a writer, that there can be great pleasure in hearing words that you don't know, and it's not a stressful thing for kids. It's quite fun, and then they can go get a dictionary, or they can actually ask someone, not me, about the sailing, but, you know, he was just gripped.
Lem, you are a poet, and
yes,
a lot of people say poetry is too difficult for the average bird brain person of today. Why do you stick with poetry?
Poetry kind of bridges a gap between the abstract internal stuff and the external, you know, real world, and it matches the two, and kids love that, adults love that too. And we have a problem with poetry, in particular in England, due to the way that it's taught, and it's taught fearfully a lot of the time in comprehensive education. Those people then go on to university, they form a love of poetry, but they remember the fear that they were taught at this middle time. They become teachers, and they carry that sixth sense of fear. And that sixth sense is then passed on to children, and the cycle continues. And the reason that happens is because poetry is, in its essence, quite threatening to the status quo, I think. It deals with stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
We are the stuff of stuff. We talk about stuff.
And does it make a difference that you perform your poetry?
How articulate I am. Stuff.
You're very articulate.
With stuff of stuff.
I'm writing that down.
You there?
Owen, you were a teacher originally, and now you hold stadiums.
Yes. The teachers are the
I was on the front line. That's why
Do you feel you're more on the front line now than you were as a teacher?
Oh, no, Teaching is much more difficult because you're on 5-6 hours a day and you're on. It's like being, you know, being on the West End for 3 shows a day.
Yes.
I don't know how teachers do it because I get so tired. But that is true. I mean, as children's writers, we know if we did an event at Hay the way some of the adult writers do it, I mean, there'd be mass walkouts, there'd be screaming, yelling. I mean, children's writers, no, you have to engage. You just can't get away with that old, hi, I'm Francesca Simon.
Talking of language, I did an event yesterday with Louise Renison, author of the Georgia Nicholson series.
So funny.
And she's always inventing words. Many of them are rude, including a new word to me, which is nunga nunga. Now, I didn't know what that meant. Do you know what that means?
Well,
I can guess.
All the kids. no, you'll have to go and read the books. Or you'll have to just ask any child at Hay, basically. Okay. They all seem to know.
I think a nunga nunga is an underarm fart, isn't it?
Well, something to do, something close to the armpits, anyway. Anyway, we'll hear more from my guests, Lem Sisse, Francesca Simon and Owen Colfer, in a moment. But first, an event I was particularly lucky to be involved in this year was a sneak preview of the film The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's based on John Boyne's best-selling novel about the friendship between two boys on the opposite sides of the fence in a concentration camp in the Second World War. Shmuel's a Jewish prisoner and Bruno's dad runs the camp. I first met John Boyne 2 years ago at Hay, when no one could have imagined what a success this book was going to be. The film is to be released in September. It's directed by Mark Herman, whose previous work includes Little Voice and Brassed Off. I managed to persuade both John and Mark to give us some clips from the film.
Hello, sweetheart.
Mum, what's going on?
We're celebrating.
Celebrating?
Your father's been given a promotion.
Moving? Where to?
To the countryside.
We're not supposed to be friends, Yoni. We're meant to be enemies. Did you know that?
Well, we've just come out of the first public screening of this film, of clips at Hay, and I have to say the atmosphere was absolutely electric. So how do you two feel, John?
Well, it's very exciting, you know, to be in front of an audience where they're already quite familiar with the book, and then they can take that knowledge and see what Mark has done with it, I suppose.
Whose baby is it, by the way? It's your baby, John, and it's your baby, Mark.
No, it's both. It's both. You know, I wrote the book, Mark made the film. I heard an interesting line earlier in Jhumpa Lahiri's talk, where she said the novelist is like the grandparent of it, because you give the child away, but you have, you know, you let someone else take responsibility for it then.
Now, there were about 200 people there. They all had read the book. About 99% of the audience, I'd say, put their hands up when we asked that. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's a story about two boys. The main character is a boy called Bruno, who is taken away from his home and brought with his family to live in a new house in a very desolate area. And he slowly forms a friendship with a young boy living on the opposite side of a fence. And we realise this is a concentration camp. Bruno is the son of the commandant. His friend is a Jewish prisoner at this camp. And the novel really, and the film, is about how their friendship develops and where it leads them.
Now, this is a big film company that's doing this, and they have not interfered, as far as I could see, with the aesthetic at all. It's very, very true to the book.
I bought the rights to the book early on. I think perhaps because film companies are perhaps a little bit worried about the subject matter of it. Eventually Miramax have come in, and it's a very brave film to make, actually. And it's almost like we're attempting to make the worst ending in movie history, but it's an incredibly powerful piece, as the book was.
Let's hear a little clip. Mark, can you explain what's going on?
This is a scene where they've just arrived at the house in the countryside. Bruno has seen what he thinks is a farm, and his dad calls him in just to see what he thinks of the new house. And Bruno asks about what he's just seen through the window.
Well, what do you think? Oh, dear.
I want to go home.
Bruno, you have to at least give the place a chance. I promise you, it won't be long before you're...
Why do the farmers wear pyjamas? I can see them from my window.
The thing is, Bruno, those people, well, you see, they're not really people at all.
Is it to do with your new job?
All you need to know about my work here, Bruno, is that it's very important to our country and to you. We're working very hard to make this world a better place for you to grow up in.
That's a clip there from The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. John, were there any things that you thought that he did better than you did?
There are a couple of scenes, I suppose, which work better on screen than they would work on the page, in the same way that there are some things on page that wouldn't, you know, adapt particularly well on screen. There's one scene particularly in a cellar with the propaganda film, which appears just at a moment where Bruno is really beginning to doubt his father and to worry whether he's not quite the hero that he thinks he is. I don't think you could really do that in a novel.
I mean, I think an audience today has the benefit of 60, 70 years hindsight, and it's very difficult to fight that. I mean, people will be asking, well, surely the wife knew, surely the kids know. And it's very important, I think, in the screenplay to put that scene in, just to explain that people didn't know. And you know, it's quite a convincing propaganda film, as you know, it's based on a real propaganda film.
The story's about innocence, but it's also about genocide. So should there be a minimum age at which young people should read books on such difficult subjects?
I don't think there's anything that children shouldn't read.
Obviously, it's good for children to get a broader mind of the world. Perhaps maybe there is an age, maybe they need to start that, maybe not too young.
I just read what I want, really. I'm not told what to read or what not to read.
I think children should be able to read what they want to a certain extent. The parents should be able to say as well.
I think there are some books which aren't suitable for children because they might get a nightmare.
Francesca, how cautious should we be about telling young people the whole truth, even if it's horrible?
I think it's actually really important for parents and kids to see things together. And you have to decide that as a parent, because I think it's very difficult to predict what's going to upset a child. I mean, my son at 3 was completely convulsed by the ballet of Romeo and Juliet. Not everybody being killed, that was fine. It was when Capulet pushed his daughter away and the father rejecting the child devastated him. I mean, he was inconsolable. Now, I wouldn't have predicted this. I mean, I think you can't necessarily predict with a child, but I think it's really important if you see things together or read books together that you can actually discuss them. And I think that that's really important. So I'm not that keen on protecting children as long as an adult they love and trust is there to kind of discuss it with them.
Yes, I was absolutely traumatised by Cruella de Vil for quite a while during my childhood.
Yeah, Casper the Ghost was also a really bad one. And the BBC Santa was very scary to my son.
God, Snowman used to just freak me out when I was a kid. So,
Owen, as a teacher, were there any books that you would hope your children wouldn't read?
No, I don't think so. I remember being challenged on books by parents. One was To Kill a Mockingbird, which met with considerable resistance. I think the kids should always be told the truth, and the truth should be available, but not in an exploitative way. And I think this movie could be exactly the kind of truth kids need to see and need to know that happens and remember. So I'm delighted for John, and I can't wait to see. I wish I had been here. I'd love to have seen the movie. So I think it's brilliant.
You have to wait till September.
I have to. I know. I might give him a call. I think I know his agent, so maybe I can.
Well, I know one of the girls in the film, and she hasn't seen it yet. So I think that actually you'd be lucky.
I might sit in there, but no. I think the truth needs to be told and needs to be heard. But some people use the truth as a way to platform or to springboard their own careers or movies or books, and the truth is almost secondary. Mm. But this is absolutely not one of those cases.
Mm. Lem, another issue that is brought up by this film is the importance of witness. And in one of your collections, you've quoted the great black American writer James Baldwin about the responsibility for black writers to bear witness to the times. The times are pretty horrible sometimes, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And bearing witness to them is kind of a celebration in some ways. You know, bearing witness to darkness, just as this film does, is something to be celebrated. And how
do you do this?
Well, I think by creating the poem about whatever darkness is evident is a celebration in itself. And I think that comes across, hopefully, in the piece of work that you've done and how carefully it's been presented and well-researched and enjoyed.
And enjoyment is a key thing, isn't it? And that comes up with your work, Francesca.
I think that children's books, in children's lives, are often given this big burden where their books get somehow hoiked into the same category as learning how to do fractions. And the whole point, I think, about books is that they're meant to be enjoyable. And I just think kids should read absolutely whatever they want to read and that they enjoy. And if you as a parent, and this is what happened to me, my son was reading books that I thought you shouldn't, you know, why are you just reading nonfiction and coin collection and catalogs? I read to him all the books I thought he should be reading that I wanted him to read. So I just got off his back and I had many happy years of reading to him. You know, we read The Three Musketeers and The Chronicles of Narnia. He was happy, I was happy. But I just think so many parents try to stop their kids reading books they want to read and say, no, this is educate. That's too easy for you. You should be reading a harder book. I thought, yeah, really make sure that your kid hates books. Yeah. Keep going. You're doing a great job.
It's the same thing as with poetry. Exactly the same thing.
You know, everything doesn't have to have a task and a target. I mean, books are meant to be there to be loved, and that's your goal as a parent, is to turn your kids into readers because it's so much fun.
Which it brings us to the issue of crossover fiction, which is very fashionable at the moment. For people who don't know what this is, it's books which are supposed to target adults as well as children. Do you think it's a good thing?
Well, I think a lot of the time it's accidental. I don't think... I mean, my books are probably known as crossover books, but I never mean that. It just... adults like them as well. So I think if you try and make it, if you say this is going to be a crossover book and I'm going to try and appeal to everybody, and it's like a movie thing where you hit all the markets.
Mm. I think it's too forced.
Yeah, the book suffers, and it's not a real... You just got to write the story you want to write, and hopefully someone will want to read it. But if you start deliberately targeting people, I think then your book is going to suffer.
We know that Horrid Henry is about 8, and he's... It's for about sort of 6 to 8 years.
But I never say how old he is, because I've discovered, which is accidental, because I wasn't even thinking of an audience particularly. This is unfortunate. This is just sort of how my writing works. But I know kids as young as 4, and there's teenagers, people as old as 18. You know, and adults read the books because they're funny. Mm-hmm. So I would hate to have a kind of a limit on it. I think books, you can really enjoy books. I mean, children of that age are able to read it, so that's something. I mean, they're meant for. You know, as books for children who have just learned to read. So there's certain things that I do with repetition to kind of help that. But other than that, I think it's pretty open. I mean, you do write, you hope the books are going to be enjoyable, that people are going to want to read them.
Thank you very much.
And there's millions of adults reading your books to their kids. And I mean, I know I'm reading and I'm laughing away. And so it's reaching a whole audience that you don't even, that are not reflected in the sales, if you know what I mean.
And it reaches boys and girls, which is another important point, isn't it?
That you both get, well, since I read so much to my child, I'm very, very aware of how important it is that adults enjoy. I don't like books that tell jokes that go above kids' heads, but adults need to enjoy reading the books, because then their kids pick up, God, this is really fun. We're really enjoying this together.
Well, that's it for today's programme. Many thanks to my guests, Owen Colfer, Francesca Simon and Lem Sisse. Tomorrow, a specially recorded session from the incredible Senegalese kora player Sekou Keita and his band, and an insight into the agony and ecstasy of the Tour de France reenacted in the hills around Hay. You can hear it all if you go to guardian.co.uk/haycast. But for now, I will leave you with a tiny taste of what Salman Rushdie said about his childhood reading at his event yesterday, followed by a little music from the winners of the Radio 3 World Music Awards for Europe, who played here on Sunday evening, the Andalusian group Son de la Frontera.
What is the best book I've ever read?
And why is it the best book? Yeah?
Gosh, I can't answer the question.
Well, think again.
Well, I could lie.
Well, okay, start with a lie, and then you'll suddenly be inspired.
Well, the first... book that I remember making a colossal impact on me, unoriginally but truthfully, was Alice in Wonderland. And I thought that it was even as a child I thought it, and then reading it again as an adult, I still thought it.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.